Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith. Generosity is a fruit of the Spirit, isn't it? And as a fruit grows, generosity can grow. It can be learnt. Just hold that thought. Today, last week, we were doing a series through Acts, and last week we got to Acts 13, and then next week we get to, I think, Acts 21. And so I'm actually going to preach on Acts 12 to 20 today. Okay, so that's really quite exciting, and we're going to go through that really quickly. Just to give the context from Acts 12, the persecution of the church in Jerusalem ratcheted up, first with the assassination of James by the sword. James was the first of the apostles to be martyred. Must have been devastating for the small group of apostles is killed. And at the same time, Peter, the leader of the apostles, was imprisoned with the intention of him being executed. But then there is an angelic jailbreak where an angel just comes and gets Peter out of that jail. Literally, he's likely to be executed the following day. He's broken out of jail by an angel. Herod gets to hear of it. He thinks it's the fault of all the guards, so he has the whole lot executed. But fairly soon, Herod himself would be dead as well. All this is happening in Jerusalem and Judea. Further up the coast, in Antioch, in Syria, Barnabas and Saul are part of a leadership group of a new center for both Jewish and Gentile Christianity. The Jerusalem church was purely Jewish, but it's breaking into the Gentile world up in Antioch, being led by Paul and Barnabas up there. And then we come to Acts 13, where the Antioch church sent out Paul and Barnabas, and we have Paul's missionary journeys. So perhaps we can run that video graphic. So the first missionary journey of Paul and Barnabas goes over to Cyprus, and then at Salamis, they preach in the synagogue. Then they move to Paphos, where Paul encounters Elymas, the sorcerer, and he strikes him blind. But Sergius Paulus, the proconsul, believes. Then they move on to Perga. For reasons we don't understand, John Mark, their assistant, abandons them. They move on to Pisidian Antioch, preach at the synagogue, but the hierarchy of the Jews, they've had a good response, but the hierarchy come against them, and so they have to move on. They go to Iconium, same deal. They preach in the synagogue. Lots of people believe, but the hierarchy of the Jews come against them in sight opposition, and they have to flee down to to Lystra. They heal a cripple, and Paul and Barnabas are mistaken for gods and worshipped, but then the mob turn on them, stone Paul. They have to escape to Derbe, where they build a big core of believers, and then they backtrack all the way back to Antioch, and they stay in Antioch for a while, reporting on their mission there. Then we come to the second missionary journey. This starts in Jerusalem, where Paul and Barnabas have gone to settle a dispute about whether Gentile believers need to become Jewish. After they sorted that out, they move back to Antioch, where they have a big row. Barnabas goes off one way to Cyprus. Paul goes up overland into Asia, and he's taken Silas with him. And there at Lystra, he picks up Timothy, a young man at this stage who becomes a very significant player in the early church. They move on through that country and they reach Troas. And there at Troas, the Holy Spirit stops them from going inland. Instead, they get a vision of a man from Macedonia, and they go across to Macedonia to Philippi, where Lydia is the first European convert. They get thrown into jail. They have another jailbreak through an earthquake. The jailer becomes a Christian, and then they move on to Thessalonica. There they get loads of converts, but the hardliners oppose them again, so they have to jump ship from there and escape to Berea. Again, loads of converts, but the Thessalonian opposition come down to Berea, and Paul has to go off to Athens, leaving Silas and Timothy there. He preaches in Athens, then he moves on to Corinth, and he stays in Corinth for 18 months, living with Priscilla and Aquila, until ultimately he gets holed up in court, and he moves on to Ephesus. Meanwhile, he's written 1 and 2 Thessalonians. In Ephesus, he meets just one Sabbath, and he moves on to Jerusalem, and then on to Antioch. The third missionary journey. Paul sets off to strengthen the churches in Galatia. Then he gets to Ephesus. He spends 3 years in Ephesus. Starts off preaching in the synagogue, but he soon moves to a base in a school. He stays there until there's a riot by the worshippers of the goddess Artemis, or Diana. Paul's disciples, Gaius and Aristarchus, are taken by the mob, but later released. And during this time, Paul writes 1 Corinthians. He moves on to Macedonia. He writes again to the Corinthian church, and he writes the letter to the Galatians. He goes on to Greece, and he stays there for 3 months. And he's about to sail to Syria, but he hears of a plot against him, and so instead he returns by land back up to Macedonia. And during that time, he's written the letter to the Romans. In Troas, Paul preaches all night, and a young man called Eutychus falls out of the window. He's dead. And then Paul raises him from the dead. He moves on to Miletus. He meets the elders of the Ephesian church in Miletus, says goodbye to them, and then on to Jerusalem. And from Jerusalem, he will ultimately go to Rome. And that is Acts 13 to 20. It's an incredible story of life and explosive growth in the early church throughout Asia, what we call Turkey today, and throughout Macedonia and Greece and beyond. And we see a repeated pattern. Everywhere that Paul goes, he starts off going to the synagogue. Remember, the early church started off as entirely Jewish. And that's where Paul starts. He goes to the synagogue. And there, he's generally warmly received. Lots of people become believers. But it seems there is almost always a minority who rise up opposing the gospel. And this tension between the Jews and this newly confident Gentile church that is also emerging comes to a head, and they go down to Jerusalem, to the Council of Jerusalem, where the apostles, James the brother of Jesus, and Peter, the leader of the apostolic group, pronounce that actually they believe that it was always God's intention to include non-Jews in his salvation plan. And therefore, membership of the church was not to be based purely on ethnicity or on observance of the Torah, but actually simply on faith in Jesus. And so the gospel is going beyond the Jewish subculture into the Roman world, and there is then an ensuing clash of cultures. where the gospel reaches out into a world that has a completely different set of values and beliefs. And of course, that makes it so incredibly resonant with our own time, where we, the church, live in a world that has a very, very different culture and set of values and beliefs to us. So what a story. There are churches sprouting up everywhere. Churches at Antioch, Salamis, Paphos, Perga, Pisidian Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, Troas, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Athens, Corinth, Ephesus, Ptolemais, which is near Tyre, Caesarea, and Jerusalem. And no doubt there are others that weren't even mentioned. It's an incredible story of the early church just bursting out of its early confines and being received, the gospel prospering, and it's growing like wildfire all over the place. Our story at St. Barnabas cannot rival the story of the early church. But you know, we have seen the Lord bring incredible growth and life through this church over the last 30 years. We have seen hundreds of people born again. We have planted quite a number of churches: Mill Hill East Church, Oakley Community Church, Emmanuel Network Church, which started, it's now finished, but it did marvelous work for about 7 or 8 years. Golders Green Parish Church we planted into, The Space, which is a house church, Church at Five, and this autumn we're going to be starting church planting projects on the Grange in East Finchley and on Millbrook Park over towards Mill Hill. So it's life and growth bursting out from this church. In addition to that, we have sent out mission partners and associate mission partners across the world. We have Mark and Rachel Landrum with us today. We have 27 mission partners and associate mission partners in 5 continents across the world as I speak. Coming back to the early church, how was it funded? How was it funded? You've got all these missionaries, traveling missionaries like Paul and Silas and Timothy. You've also got funding various people on the ground. In the early church held widows in very high regard and funded them as part of the ministry. There was also hospitality to be arranged, people to stay on their way through. There was care for the poor. There was no welfare state. They had to care for their own poor. And no doubt there were other projects as well. How was it funded? Truth is, we'll probably never discover exactly how the early church was funded, but the principle that the work of God had to be funded by the sacrificial giving of the believers is a clear theme in the New Testament. That's how it was funded. It was funded by the gifts of the believers. Now, there is one facet of Paul's third missionary journey. Do you remember the third missionary journey where he headed off through Turkey and up to Macedonia and down to Greece? All that one. There's a facet of it that's not even mentioned in Acts by the writer Luke. We're not quite sure why. But we know from Paul's letter that the reason for that third missionary journey was that Paul was traveling around these churches that he'd already planted, making a collection for the church in Jerusalem. Excuse me. The Jerusalem church was the place where the apostles were based. It was like the parent church. It was like the headquarters of the worldwide missionary movement that was springing up. And that whole project needed to be funded. And so they made a collection. This collection is unique in the ancient world. Never before had anything like it been attempted. Would the people give? Well, yes. As it turned out, they did give, and they gave extraordinarily generously. As Paul went round, he picked up people from each donor church. And so we get Timothy and Gaius and Aristarchus and Sopater and Pyrrhus and Secundus and Tychicus and Trophimus. He's got quite a big party traveling with him by the end, because each church is sending their representative to check that the money is going to get to where it is intended. And so we have this little window here of one element of how the New Testament church was funded, by the making of this extraordinary collection. But stepping back from that for a moment, I want to suggest to you that there are two fundamental ways in which the church back then and now was and is funded. And the two ways are tithing and free will offerings. And at this point, I can hear people mentally and emotionally running for cover. Because I think I need to do a little bit of myth busting about tithing. Tithing is the practice of giving the first 10% of your income to the church. Did you get that? It's giving the first 10%, not the last 10%, the dregs. No, the first 10% of your income, the first fruits, as the Bible might term it, to the church. Not to other pet projects, to the church. That's the practice of tithing. And as I describe it, there are, if you've been a Christian for more than a few months, you'll probably fall into one of two camps on tithing. There are those people who are all for tithing. You know, they say, right, tithing is the command of God, and you have to obey it, and if you do, you're going to be blessed. That's one camp. And if you're in that camp, you'll know it. And then there's the other camp that says, tithing, it's in the Old Testament. It's nothing to do with us. It's barely mentioned in the New Testament. It's not relevant anymore. And if you're in that group, you know who you are as well. So which one is right? Tithing is a command we must follow, or it's Old Testament, it's irrelevant. Well, as always, there's an element of truth in both. Tithing is an Old Testament command. It is barely mentioned in the New Testament. It appears in three books in the New Testament: Matthew, Luke, and Hebrews. And it's not really taught on in the New Testament, or if it is taught on, possibly in Hebrews a little bit, it's very oblique. However, remember that the majority of the early church, in fact, all of the early church to start off with, but the majority of the early church, as it expanded, were Jewish. And they were coming from the practice of tithing as a requirement that was absolutely integral to their religious practice. I do not believe that this would be the one practice that they would suddenly stop. Oh, we've become followers of Jesus now. We're not going to do that thing that we did before. No. Of course they didn't. Whilst the New Testament doesn't actually mention it, it makes sense that tithing would become normative in the early church. Now, there are some mentions of tithing in the New Testament, and they are interesting, because Jesus, in mentioning tithing in Matthew 23 and Luke 11, he comes in the woe to you sections. Do you remember the woe to you sections? Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees! You hypocrites! Oh, there it is, up on the screen. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin. You know, you're tithing, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law: justice, mercy, faithfulness. But then Jesus goes on to say, and this is a crucial thing for us to understand, you should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. So here is Jesus actually affirming the practice of tithing, which he doesn't do for all the Old Testament practices. He's affirming it. So is tithing Old Testament and not relevant? Well, it is Old Testament, but I believe it is still relevant. Some have reacted to the excesses and the manipulation of prosperity teaching by chucking out the baby with the bathwater. I believe that tithing is still relevant. Is it to be adhered to? Well, not as law, because we're set free from the law. But yes, as a grace, as a wonderful thing that we can do joyfully. Galatians 5 says this: For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity to indulge your flesh, but through love, serve one another. In other words, we don't abandon the Old Testament in law in order to just live as however we please, disregarding it. We don't use our freedom to indulge the flesh. Think about the Sermon on the Mount. You remember the Sermon on the Mount, that sermon Jesus preached? He repeatedly said this: you have heard it said, but I tell you. You have heard it said, you shall not murder, but I tell you, don't even get angry. You have heard it said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you, don't even look at a woman lustfully. You have heard it said, anyone divorces his wife, give her a certificate. But I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality causes her to be a victim of adultery. You've heard it said, do not break your oath. But I tell you, do not swear at all. So when Jesus takes the Old Testament law, let me ask you this question. When he takes the Old Testament law, does he raise the bar or lower the bar? Which one do you think it is? He always raises it. He always raises it, doesn't he? Every time he raises it. So when the Old Testament teaches that you give 10%, do you think the bar is going to be raised or lowered? Is it okay to give 5% now? Do you see? Now, those who have rationalized that that tithing is Old Testament and no longer relevant to us, I need to ask you, honestly, are you giving 10% or more now? Or are you giving less? Because if you are giving less, are you not using your freedom as an opportunity to indulge the flesh? You are free, of course. We're free from the law. But we should not use our freedom to indulge the flesh. Peter has presented our financial budget, and it is not a comfortable situation we find ourselves. We are facing a financial crisis at St. Barnabas. We ran a £74,000 deficit last year. If that continues, we will be bankrupt. We will be making mass redundancies. We will be shutting down ministries here, there, and everywhere. We cannot go on like that. And this should not be like this. We should have sufficient money to pay our staff really well, to give money away in exceptional generosity, to look at a new mission project and say, yeah, let's do that, rather than always have to say, I don't know whether we can afford that. And the truth is, if everyone who calls St. Barnabas their church was tithing, we would not have a financial problem. And so I need to ask you to step up now. I need to challenge us to step up. Jane and I have always taken the attitude that we should start off with our giving by giving a minimum of 10% to the church. And actually, we've tried to give significantly more than 10% to the church. And why do we do that? We do that because we want to live out generosity. It's a fruit of the Spirit. We want to live it out. But also, we want to avoid money becoming a stronghold in our lives, taking too much of a hold over us, a clutching on our hearts, you know, because money does do that, doesn't it? And so we want to give loads of money away so that there is a light touch in our lives for money. And if you're sitting here today and you're saying to yourself, I really want to honor God with my money, how should I go about that? I want to commend to you tithing, giving 10%, starting off by giving 10%. You may say, well, I want to be free. You are free. You are free. I want you to be free to give as much as God directs you to give. And if you're really listening to the Lord, that might be quite a lot. Some of you will be sitting here thinking, 10%, I can't. You know, that's just not attainable. And if you've not heard this kind of teaching before, I understand that. You may have to work up to it. You may have to start with 5%. And then after a couple of months, shift it up and shift it up and shift it up. May not be able to do it all at once. But God will honor your intentions. Because after all of our money is God's, isn't it? If we've given our hearts to Jesus, everything we have is God's. We're only giving him what is already his. And just think, he's allowing you to keep up to 90%. I mean, how cool is that? Now, I do know that many Christians do tithe, but they split it. So they give their 10%, but they give like half of it to the church and half of it to other pet projects. And I want to suggest to you that if you're doing that, you're confusing tithing with a free will offering. Now, a free will offering is also an Old Testament concept. And it's actually not specifically mentioned in the New Testament at all. It's completely Old Testament. But the principle of a free will offering is described a lot in the New Testament. It was a gift given in response to a particular need, or as a special act of worship, perhaps in fulfillment of a vow, or as a special act of thanksgiving because God had done something wonderful for you. And of course, all our gifts are free will offerings, our tithes. Are free will offerings as well. But I use the term free will offering to differentiate from that tithe, that regular committed thing, and this extra over and above thing that we give. So we have instance of it in Acts 4, where some of the believers came and laid large amounts of money at the apostles' feet. And indeed, the collection in Paul's third missionary journey, that was a free will offering, going around collecting it. And Paul writes about some of the churches that contributed. Listen to this. "And now, brothers and sisters, I want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches." You remember them? Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. "In the midst of a very severe trial and their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty, welled up rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded for us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the Lord's people." Now, this is not something that I have experienced very often. People coming to me and urgently pleading to give us more money. You know, I don't have people grabbing at my legs saying, "Oh, Henry, please, can I give you more money?" It just hasn't been happening. But that's what happened in Paul's experience with the Macedonian churches. How amazing was that? Generosity is a fruit of the Spirit. It grows. It can be learned. So in summary, the first 10% we start giving to the church. Of course, it doesn't stop us from giving to our own charities, the things that we're interested in, on top of that, those kind of free will offerings, those extra offerings. Jane and I, we start by giving at least 10%. We've tried to exceed the 10% significantly. But then after that, we also give to various charities. We support some people, and we give to the Go and Grow Project. The Go and Grow Project is part of our free will offering. It's over and above our regular giving. Those are our response to need, our act of worship, our offering of thanksgiving to the Lord for all he has done for us. Have we found it hard giving such significant proportions of our income away? Yes. I don't earn that $60,000 that seemed to appear on the screen. I earn a lot less than that. And yes, we found it hard. London's an expensive place to live. But we have known the blessing of God over our finances. Consistently, we've seen God not only supply our needs, but actually bless us as well. And we've continued to try and be faithful in lavish generosity in the way we give. Because God loves generosity. When we are generous to him, it's like he cannot help himself but be generous in response. And so, friends, I preach this today because we need you to respond. This is a crucial moment for our church. In the next year, we're going to be moving to Solar House. There is the opportunity for extraordinary expansion of our ministries and opportunities for the gospel to go out into North Finchley. But we cannot do that in the state that our finances are at the moment. We need you to step up. If you're not tithing yet, I ask you to prayerfully take that to the Lord. If you are, maybe you can step up to the next level of generosity and say, "Well, I want to go a bit beyond that." Because we're on a mission from God, aren't we? And he is going to bless us enormously through our faithfulness. Why don't we stand together? Natalie, do you want to come back? Father, all things come from you. And when we give, we only give what is already yours. So, Lord, I pray that you would make us courageous, that you would make us faithful, that we would step out with you. We would not fear not having enough money, but we would give and give and give, because generosity is a fruit of the Spirit. Grow it in us, we pray. Amen.